Welcome to Amici, news and insight from the New York Judiciary and the Unified Court System. I'm John Carr. Today we are fortunate to have as our guest the Honorable Betty Weinberg Ellerin, the retired presiding justice of the Appellate Division, First Department. Justice Ellerin was the first woman deputy chief administrative judge for the New York City Courts and the first woman appointed to the Appellate Division, First Department. She is now senior counsel to the Manhattan law firm of Alston & Byrd. Justice Ellerin also chairs the New York State Judicial Committee on Women in the Courts, and that is the focus of our chat today. Judge Ellerin, first, what is the Judicial Committee on Women in the Courts? When and why was it formed? How was it comprised?
Okay. To give you the answer to that, we have to go back a little to the early 1980s so that you get the historical perspective of how we came about. At that time, there were some academic studies done at the University of California, Santa Cruz, by a sociology professor named Norma Wickler, who's no longer with us. And in those papers, she raised questions about whether women were being treated fairly in the court system in California. And, of course, her observations were based on anecdotal information. She herself was not a lawyer. In any event, at that time, the National Association of Women Judges was a newly formed organization, also with its roots in California, and they had a conference out there. And she partnered with that group to put on a program raising these issues. At that conference, consisting of about 100 people, I think, I was not involved at that time, was a judge from New Jersey named Marilyn Loftus. She was very impressed with the program, came back to New Jersey, spoke to her chief judge, Robert Wilentz, also a very progressive man, and he took it to heart and said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to form a task force to look into that to see whether the data supports those kinds of conclusions. Of course, all you had to do was speak to some of the women who had been around a while. And believe me, we could have told you, yeah, those conclusions were very real. In any event, the New Jersey Task Force reported in 1984, and it evoked a front-page New York Times article, which not only I saw, but several others. And at that time, I was the administrative judge for the courts of the city of New York. I started to get phone calls, one from the late Honorable Sybil Hart Cooper, who was president of the New York Women Judges. And she said, Betty, we got to have a task force. I said, I agree with you. And Lynn Shaffron, who's a leader in the movement, and a couple of others. And they looked to me to set up an appointment with the chief judge at that time, Lawrence Cook, a remarkable man. He came from Monticello, a small town, one of the most enlightened, fair people you could ever want to meet. And that was his touchstone, fairness, in the system. In any event, they said, you set up an appointment for us. And, of course, when I called and told him I'd, we'd like to meet him, he gave us an appointment. And we told him that we thought New York should have such a task force as well. Well, he was a little chagrined at that because he himself was so fair, had appointed women to committees, had appointed me as, city administrator, et cetera. He thought maybe that was sort of a criticism of him. But I took him aside privately as I could because of our relationship and indicated that was not the case at all and that the women really felt they needed it here in New York. I get a call the next morning. Judge, he always called me Judge. I've listened to what you said, and I am going to set up such a task force. Well, I'm ecstatic. I got a whole list of people that I know are going to be great on this task force. He didn't ask me. He put together a task force that was, when I looked at it, I was sort of taken aback. He had leaders of white shoe firms, the Brahmins of the bar. He had legislators. He had presidents of bar associations. He did have a couple of leaders, of the women's movement, so someone like Fern Scher, somebody from upstate, March Crow. He also, when we were sort of upset about some of the look of the committee, he agreed to have advisors, and that included Lynn Schaffern, Marjorie Fields, people who were very well known, and Norma Wickler in the field.
Let me interrupt you a second. Why do you think he comprised the committee, the task force, in that way?
I'm getting to that.
Okay,
I'm getting to that. And they started their work. And lo and behold, he gave all the resources necessary for that committee to function. But guys like Oscar Riebhausen and Hal Fales, who had these large firms, they became not only converts, they were crusaders, because they had had hearings, listening sessions, they set out questionnaires, and, you know, there's nobody who's a stronger advocate than, in a sense, a convert. They realized, they had never thought about this, but when they heard all of these stories about the bias against women at so many levels, they really were committed to try to root it out. So I always say, he was right, I was wrong. He knew what he was doing. Putting those people at the head of a committee or in the committee really gave it a certain credibility that was immeasurable. It really did. And aside from expanding the resources available to do the work of the committee, they went upstate, downstate. I think they sent out 10,000 questionnaires. They went, had public hearings. Whatever you want, they had it. And it took 2 years for them to come up with a report. It was over 300 pages documenting in exquisite detail the elements of bias against women within our court system, and also touching upon the other participants in the justice system. For example, on the criminal side, the police, the DAs, etc., and the need for various resources and what have you. And one of the biggest they made recommendations for the court system to address very specific issues. You want me to tell you in a general way what the task force report said?
Well, as I remember, the one of the task force first acts was a release in April of 86. And the opening sentence is often quoted to this day, and I will quote that. Gender bias against women litigants, attorneys, and court employees is a pervasive problem with grave consequences. Women are often denied equal justice, equal treatment, and equal opportunity. It challenges the bench and the bar and the public to engage in intense self-examination and, quote, demand the justice system more fully committed to fairness and equality. I know you've described the day that was released as a milestone in your life. Can you tell me why?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, listen, you know, I grew up as a woman lawyer a long time ago. I was there when I would go into court as a young lawyer, and the judge would say, you know, we don't have secretaries answer the calendar. But the nicer ones would say, are you a lawyer? I mean, you know, that could be a little daunting. And I mean, I saw all sorts of bias. When I went out to get a job, oh, we can't hire you, you'll get married and get pregnant. I always used to say, I wish you'd tell my mother that, because my mother was sure once I became a lawyer that would be it. But in any event, I had felt that kind of prejudice, you know, at that time. So to me, it was like I was vindicated. The things that I knew were going on were now a matter of public record. And once they become a matter of public record, they can be addressed. And it was the brilliance of the task force report that they made very specific recommendations on very specific issues. they really came out with four major areas. Because, you know, while there's bias at innumerable levels, there's only so much you can do in one report. And what they focused on were, one, the status of women litigants, and primarily in situations involving domestic violence and rape. And also women's economic rights, how women fared after divorce, and what other obstacles they faced in the, you know, economic area. You've heard of the feminization of poverty.
Sure.
I'll tell you, that's very real. And the fact that women, even today, that's, I know, another question, do not make the same amount for equal work. They don't get equal pay for equal work.
Just to put it in perspective now, at this point, by the time this report comes out, Judge Cook, I believe, is retired, and Judge Sal Wachler is chief judge.
Correct.
And so the Judge Wachler, apparently he picked up that baton and kept that going.
I got to tell you, we have been so fortunate in New York with our chief judges. Wachler was terrific. He took the report and ran with it. And I'll get to the others in a minute. But one of the strongest recommendations, I told you they recommended specific things, was to establish a subsequent committee that would be charged with implementing those recommendations. And the name of the committee was the New York Committee to Implement the Recommendations of the New York Task Force on Women in the Courts. That was quite a mouthful, as you could see, but the idea was a perfect one. And he appointed Judge Catherine McDonald as the chair, and that was an inspired choice. She was fabulous. She was maybe 4'11 in height, but let me tell you, she was a giant in all of the ways that counted. And she was a force unto herself, and she was committed to making this work. The name of the committee changed with Judge Kay. She came up with the New York State Committee on Women in the Courts, which is a much more manageable one. And, of course, she was wonderful in terms of supporting us, as was her successor, Judge Lipman, as is the current chief judge, Judge DeFiore. They all have been absolutely so intensely committed to the work of the committee and to making sure that we succeed and that bias within our system, insofar as it's against women, actually bias against any group, is rooted out. So, you know, that goes to the support we got from the various chief judges, and that tells you how our name changed to what it is now, the New York State Judicial Committee on Women in the Courts.
So there's a lot of momentum here. Starts with Judge Cook, gets continued by Judge Wachler, gets promoted again by Judge Kay and Judge Lipman, and now Judge DeFiore.
Exactly.
So where are we now? Is it still a problem, or have we moved beyond? Is gender bias still, as we said before, a pervasive problem? Are women denied equal justice, equal treatment, equal opportunity?
And we have made some progress, actually a lot of good progress. However, we also have a long way to go. You know what I want to read you? A statement that Judge DeFiore made recently, because she summed it up very well in a short paragraph as to the fact that we have made substantial progress, and we have, and I can, you know, detail a lot of that, but this is how she concluded. But we must continue to advocate without hesitation on behalf of women on critical issues like the domestic violence, sexual harassment, fair treatment of women litigants, pay equity, family leave, and on and on. There is no challenge, no shortage of challenges for us to address. And she's absolutely right. And, for example, we take a step ahead, and then because of budgetary constraints, we lose that step ahead. I'm talking about we children's waiting rooms throughout the state because we recognized that poor women couldn't afford child court care if they had to go to court, whether it was on a domestic violence case, a family matter, to go to housing court. They had to have a place to leave their children. So we were able to get the court system to spearhead having these children's waiting rooms. Then the budget crisis came in about 8-9 years ago, and bingo, most of those waiting rooms were either shut down or the hours were curtailed so sharply. For example, one of the problems that a working mother, and today, unfortunately, all mothers have to work, whether they have custody of children or not, is that they would have to take a day off from work to come in to ensure that the orders that they were granted were enforced. You know, delay was truly lethal to these women. It would be wonderful to have evening hours, in court. Well, the budget precludes that, unfortunately. So now we're working to try to reopen many of these waiting rooms. Listen, I got Cy Vance to agree to open one in Manhattan. The family courts all have them, pretty much. That they left alone for the most part, although even there, some had to close down. But we don't have one in Manhattan for the housing court attendants or for those who have criminal court, people in criminal court that they have to go to, or even in matrimonial cases. So Cy Vance has agreed that they will, pay for the renovation of some space in the courthouse so that there can be a children's waiting room, for which I'm very grateful, and he agreed to sponsor it for at least 5 years.
That's great. Let's take a step back, and I'd like to talk about your history. When did you first think of becoming a lawyer? Okay, go ahead.
I told you that this could be a very long phone call.
That's fine.
Okay, one of the things that we recognized at the outset was that many judges, particularly those sitting in matrimonial parts, one, were insensitive to the concerns of women in those parts. They came at it, first of all, women's credibility. That was always found to be a serious problem, whether it was in a matrimonial case, whether it was in a rape case. I don't have to tell you. That's the one area, by the way, I got to tell you, we've made tremendous progress, at least within the court system, in this area. I think even upstate, when I was a young law clerk, rape cases were treated, sneeringly, laughingly, even by the DAs and certainly some judges. That's no longer the case. The DA's offices take those cases very seriously, and for which they deserve great credit, and the police as well. I attribute some of that to our work, where we have held conferences, we have a lot of educational programs, but I think also many of these TV programs, that put a different spin on those kinds of cases have been very helpful in educating the public as well, as judges. So education has always been one of our biggest functions, and we do that. We're also a catalyst in many areas. For example, we recognize that there are now, and this was some years ago, a lot of foreign women litigants who use our courts. Well, they're at a terrible disadvantage, not just as women, but because of language difficulties, et cetera, and cultural differences.
Sure.
And we were very concerned about what was going on vis-a-vis the interpreters. And I got to give Fern Scher credit for this. She picked up on that, and I designated her to, push it with our administration. They set up a special committee for that, or I don't know what it's called, and they now take that very seriously. I'm not sure we've completely won the battle, but at least it's on the radar screen. They know that you have to get interpreters, one, who are not interpreting things that are not being said or are trying to, in a sense, scare the woman with, in our culture, we don't do this, because that has always been our concern. But people who, when they take the oath, really fulfill it. And there are really problems about getting enough of the various languages, I think 169 or something. I mean, this is really a monumental program to have to meet, but at least it's something the courts take very seriously, and lawyers know that. You want me to go on?
Sure, sure.
Okay, wait, we have put out various publications. The one that really is sought throughout the country is something called Fair Speech. You know, it was always a fireman, a mailman, whatever. Well, the world has changed. So it is a mail carrier, police officer. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Gender-neutral language. Now, I got to tell you honestly, years ago when they first came out with when the women's movement or the feminist movement would get very upset if you called them girls, I used to say, listen, I don't care what you call me, just pay me the same. But I realized they're right. What you call someone is a very significant factor. That sets the tone of how you think about the person and how you treat the person. And so that booklet, Judge McDonald was the chair when that booklet came out, and we had a wonderful counsel at that time who retired about a year and a half ago, Jill Goodman. She's a wonderful writer, and she took care of that. We then had a booklet on potential scenarios of, you know, bias in the courtroom and how a judge could address them. We didn't give him an answer. What we did was we had various judges give proposed answers, and we would we distributed the book to give judges an idea about some of the ways in which they could address bias, and that has been very helpful. We've worked also with various bar associations and other community organizations like Sanctuary, Safe Horizons, etc. But with regard to the bar associations, ironically, while I was a member of the implementation committee from the beginning. Judge Wachler appointed me. I was not on the task force, but I was on the implementation committee from the beginning. But I also was appointed as chair of the city bar as Women in the Courts Committee that was established right after the task force reports. So I was very, you know, into all of the elements that were stated. And one of the biggest things was the delay in getting motions for interim support decided. I mean, judges would sit on that for months and months. And here's a woman who has no other means of income, who basically is starving. So they, you know, that's, she was starved in submission. Well, I got my Bar Association Committee to recommend a court rule that those motions be decided within 30 days of submission. I want you to know, Judge Wachtler had that enacted, and that's on the books.
Wow.
Yes. Then that committee, the Bar Association has multiple committees. The issue of child support guidelines was hot because there was a national law, and, you know, the question, should the state pass such a law? And in my view, absolutely, because that would be, give some predictability and some assurance that child support awards would be made. So they had, the matrimonial committee was dead set against it. The children in the law committee, they were very for it. Well, I'm the women in the courts committee at the association, and I must say my committee was great. They were very responsive, you know, to issues that I would put forth. And I said, I think we should take a position, and they agreed with me. And we took a position, not only for it, but our threshold was higher than that of the children in the law. And the president at that time was a lawyer from a large firm who also had no knowledge of this area. And when we met, the three chairs met, he was great. Whatever I said went, and he recommended it to the executive committee. And after a pretty big fight, I understand, because I was not on the executive committee at that time, they passed it. And that was one of the criteria that the governor pointed to as the basis for signing that legislation. Okay. So you have to come at it from multiple ways. You can't do anything in isolation because this is such a broadly rooted, you know, these are broadly rooted problems, societal problems. But the one thing we can do is make sure that the courts do their part to try to resolve these issues.
Well, hopefully that, it sounds like I think that is starting to happen, but Now let's take a step back. I want to know about you. When did you first think of becoming a lawyer?
Well, I was lucky that I had a father who came from Europe. Had he been born in America, he would have been a college professor. He was that kind of a mind. He used to talk to me when I was a kid, 7, 8 years old, like I was an adult, about politics. Remember, we were on the edge of World War II. And he also was, a union man, a very liberal guy, and he talked about what it was like on the picket lines, et cetera. So when I was about 12, I said, I'm going to become a labor lawyer, and I'm also going to become a United States senator, because that's where big decisions are made. Well, neither of those came true, but I went in another direction. And I was, from the time I was 12, I was going to become a lawyer. My mother was not happy. My father wasn't either, because he was depression scarred. And he said, a secretary or a teacher always makes a living. A lawyer will starve to death. Well, children don't listen. And I worked my way through school, and I went to law school.
In law school, did you experience any gender discrimination? I mean, there couldn't have been a whole lot of women in your law school class.
Well, I went to NYU, and I must say, we were ahead of the curve. Yeah, we were a very small, comparatively small group. I would say in the day session, we must have had 12 to 15 women. And, I knew certain things were going to be said or I was going to be confronted, so I was prepared. So the first week, some guy comes over to me and he says, what are you here for, to get a husband? So I said, well, yeah, actually, that's what I was going to do. But when I saw what was available, I thought I'd get the degree instead. No one ever bothered me again. No, you have to, be realistic. Also, I had a study group, mostly males. I never allowed being a woman to sort of scare me into anything. I feel, I always had a certain amount of self-confidence, whatever. And, I went forward.
And then you're admitted, and you're still certainly a very small minority of the bar. Did you experience gender discrimination in the workforce?
Yes, very much so. In getting a job, that was the toughest. Because when you'd go really see an employer, they were very reluctant to hire women. Ultimately, I got a job because I was a woman. I went to a maritime firm, and the person who interviewed me was a young guy who I heard him go into the, to the partner and say, listen, this is a bright young woman there. I think we should hire her because she'll be able to do things some of the guys can't do. And he's screaming, oh, woman! Anyhow, they hired me as a law clerk. And when I left 2 years later, he's yelling, "You can't go, the partner, you can't go. I'm building a department around you, okay?" But that was very fortunate, and I was able to do things that some of the men in the office couldn't. I had to deal with seamen, and when they would see me, I was a lady. Let me tell you, they wouldn't, like, be scared to death. They would be like little angels. So I could talk to them in a way that some, they, you know, the partners couldn't. So I did very well there. But I knew it wasn't for me. I knew I did want to get married, that I wanted to have children, and that this was not the place where I was going to be able to do it. Fortunately, the opportunity presented itself for me to get a job as a law clerk to a judge in a court that no longer exists, the city court. It's now part of what we call the civil court. It had maritime jurisdiction. So when I went to see the judge who was looking for a law clerk, and he looked at my resume, et cetera, he was thrilled. He says to me, "Listen, I'll swear you in now, or do you want your parents to come this afternoon?" I said, "Oh, no, I got to give my office a couple of weeks' notice." Well, he was, "I'll swear you in, and then you can give them notice." Anyhow, so he hired me. And I was, at that time, I don't know if there may have, another woman came in for a short time, but I was the only woman for a time. And you have a question about why I said I didn't suffer by being a woman.
Yes.
And that's true. And I'll tell you why, for a funny reason, in a way. I'm a good lawyer. I'll be immodest and say that. And immediately I wrote a Siemens case came in, and I wrote a decision, and that was really a very good one, and they weren't used to that because I had, you know, had the federal case background and all of that. Who helped you with this? They asked me, the librarian. I said, I wrote it. Well, Harry Frank had a brilliant law clerk. Why? Because a woman wasn't supposed to be smart. They expected so little of you that if you were good, you became brilliant, you were exceptional, et cetera. Mm. And so that stood me in pretty good stead, both in the civil court or city court, and then when we went to the Supreme Court. Actually, I was the first woman ever appointed to a regularly elected Supreme Court judge in the state of New York in 1965. Would you believe that?
I know it to be true, so I do believe it. But how did you position yourself politically to be in the position to get that?
I did belong to a local political club. I was newly married. We went up, and a friend of mine was very active. So, I mean, I would go up. But in those days, you had to stand in line. I mean, there were people way ahead of me. So they apparently sent this judge several people that he found completely unqualified. So in desperation, so that they shouldn't lose the job, they sent me, even though, I mean, I was not, from their perspective, in any way, supposed to be getting any kind of an entree to a job. And that's how I got it, because the judge insisted on getting somebody who was qualified.
And once you got there, you seemed to progress awfully quickly. I mean, after 3 years in the city court, you're on the Supreme Court. Within months of that, Chief Judge Cook makes you the administrative judge.
Right.
I know you're the first woman in that position, and I'm sure the vast majority of the 425 judges you were in charge of were male. But were there any gender issues there, any pushback from the male judges who weren't used to having a woman boss, a woman administrator?
If there was, I didn't see it or know about it. Let me put it to you this way. I got along great with my law assistant, law clerk colleagues. They elected me president of their association. They would come in to me, "Betty, you have a charge, you have this." I got along very well with them. They respected me, I respected them. When I became a judge, I took the same attitude. I mean, I never had a chip on my shoulder. I never was looking that, oh, he may have looked cross-eyed at me because I was a woman. I that was just not my way. I'm a Jewish mother at heart. And so let's say I'm the city administrator, and of course, every judge has a complaint. They would call me, I got to come see you about something. I said, sure, come. And I'd say, come in the morning. And I'd have coffee and, you know, sort of a little Danish. And I had been in the system so long that I knew many of them. How's your wife? How are the kids? Et cetera. By the time we got to what his problem was, I mean, all the, you know, air had been deflated. I have, if I'll be a modest, pretty good people skills, and I did very well with them. And beyond that, Ed Koch was the mayor, and Ed Koch, you know, wanted to use judges as his whipping people. That was a time of jail overcrowding when Morris Lasker, may he rest in peace, wonderful man, the federal judge, was releasing prisoners. So Koch, because the city had not built the detention facilities that it was supposed to. So, of course, Koch needed somebody to blame. Whose fault was it? It was the judges' fault. They weren't the state judges. They weren't sentencing fast enough. They weren't doing this, etc. Well, I was not going to lie down and play dead and let him beat up on my judges. So I responded in kind, and they knew that I was, you know, standing up for them and for what they were doing. So that gave them, I would say, a lot of respect for me, and I'd say affection as well.
Now, you were a founding member of the Women's Bar of the state of New York. And
I was never the president of the state women's bar. I wasn't the New York City, New York women's bar. Once I was a judge, I could not be the president of a statewide bar association because they take political stands. The judge can't do that. However, notwithstanding that I never, you know, was the president, when they have their annual meeting of presidents, which is a social event, all the past presidents meet, and I'm always included. I'm the one non-president that comes, you know, because they frequently come to me for advice and what have you.
Now, how did the Women's Bar come to be? I think it happened in the late 60s, and you know, why was it formed? Do you recall?
Yes, very well. Because I'm going to make another admission. At that time, we had, I was the president in 69-70. After my term in the 70s, it wasn't formed, I think, until 1980. There was a young woman president named Joan Ellen Bogan, who's gone now. We had had a fight within the New York Women's Bar between those who wanted to keep it as it had been, which was just a parallel bar association where they had tea parties, or those who felt that by now we are all members of the general bars. A women's bar should have some meaning in terms of fighting for the issues that affect women as lawyers and as citizens generally. And, of course, I was in the latter group. And so they had a contested election, and they induced me to run. I was not too happy about that because by then I had three children, and, you know, I was trying to carry a full-time job, whatever. However, I said, listen, you've been hawking about this, so you got to really, in a sense, do it. So I did it, and I won. And I became very close with many of the others, some of whom were younger, and we all finally agreed that we had a focus on women's issues. Well, Joan Ellen Bogan went beyond that. She read the bylaws very carefully and said, you know something? We can form a state bar of women's bar based on these bylaws. I said, Joan, I'm not for that. I said, we're going to let some of these upstate people wag the dog. I mean, you know, their attitudes are different, whatever. No, she was committed to that. She was right, and I was wrong. And that's what we did. It was almost like a constitutional convention, the way we met who was going to have how many votes, what issues the state would take, what issues the local would. And her attitude was, and she's absolutely right on this, we could only be a strong and meaningful voice if we were united statewide. And that was true. And I was, at that time, I was the city administrator, so I had the chief judge's ear. That was Judge Cook. He used to meet quarterly with statewide bar associations, the New York State Trial Lawyers and the New York State Bar Association. So I said, Judge, you know, there's another statewide group, too, that you have to include, the Women's Bar of the State of New York. And so he met with, they were one of the statewide bar associations that were included. So that was terrific because they were able to present their, you know, agenda as well as the other bar associations. And as I said, he was wonderful on these issues.
So you made the organization and made the woman voice relevant.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You made the organization. The organization made itself very relevant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the little bit of time we have left, just some parting words of advice to women law students and new admittees. What should they know about the pioneers like you who paved their way?
Well, that it wasn't always easy, that they are inheriting a different profession than when we were there, that we fought to make certain things better and right for them, but that they also are going to confront some obstacles because they are women. The pay disparity is still very much there, but never use the fact that you're a woman. Never allow that to stand in your way of doing your best as a lawyer and having confidence in yourself as a lawyer. Find your own style and perfect it, and be prepared to speak up. Never allow a slight, a serious slight, to go unanswered. Because as long as you do that, the fight is never won, so to speak. And I am happy to say I have seen so many wonderfully bright young women lawyers right here in the firm where I am now. I mean, I really am thrilled to see them, you know, and what they produce and how much confidence they have in themselves. But I also say, don't forget your poorer sisters, the ones who can't speak for themselves, because as long as any women are an underclass, all of us are in danger. I really feel strongly about that.
Well, that's a great way to end up, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Judge Allen. Thanks for listening to Amici. If you have a suggestion for a topic on Amici, please contact me, John Carr, at 518-453-8669, or send me a note at jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.